Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Ryan Famuliner. In Missouri and across the nation, the process of executing criminals is becoming complicated. It's one of our society's most somber and impactful tasks, but how much do you know about the process? If you don't know much about it, there may be a reason for that. Two of our colleagues at St. Louis Public Radio have investigated and found that the process is shrouded in secrecy. Meantime, four people have been executed in Missouri in as many months after years of less frequent executions. Today, we'll try to shed some light on the process of executions in Missouri. We'll discuss the death penalty. How complicated is it? How transparent is it? How expensive is it? And what legal questions are there about the way it's being administered now? Joining us today to sort it out, Paul Litton is an associate professor of law at the University of Missouri. He was a member of a team that put together an analysis of Missouri's death penalty laws, procedures, and practices for the American Bar Association in 2012. Paul, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us by Skype today are two of our colleagues from St. Louis Public Radio who have been leading the coverage of the Department of Corrections' scramble to carry out executions in the past few months. Chris McDaniels, a political reporter. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Veronique LaCapra is a science reporter. Veronique, thanks to you too.
Thanks, Ryan.
All right. We'd also love to hear from you and our audience today. What do you think about Missouri's recent actions in regard to how it carries out the death penalty? Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. Okay, so just to get started, we need to do a little bit of just explaining because we're going to be operating from a lot of general knowledge as we get this conversation going. So first, maybe Chris and Veronique and Paul, you could help with this too, but who sets the method right now for how executions are carried out here in Missouri?
Well, it's kind of convoluted because the director of the Department of Corrections comes up with the protocol, but they, of course, report to the governor, and the governor can tell them that they need to come up with a new protocol. For the current one that we have, there were really three people who came up with it: the director of the Department of Corrections, George Lombardi, the director of adult institutions, David Dormeyer, and their general counsel. And those were really the three people who came up with what we have right now.
And that's the way it's supposed to be, I guess. I mean, that's the way it's
according to state statute. Yes.
Yeah. And Paul, is that similar to how other states usually handle this? I guess on a state level.
I think that's right. There are statutes that basically direct the Department of Corrections to come up with the execution protocol.
Okay. And so, Chris and Veronique, why don't we start talking about some of your recent coverage, I guess, from that operating procedure there. How did you get involved in covering this story, and what have you guys found in these recent months?
Well, so we really got into this because of a drug called propofol, which is actually a widely used medical anesthetic. It's actually the most widely used medical anesthetic in the United States, and most of it comes from Europe, from the European Union. And Missouri, though, was intending to use propofol for lethal injection. And the European Union, as a result, which is very much against the death penalty, had started to look into possibly putting a restriction on the exports of propofol from Europe to the United States, well, to anywhere, really, in order to keep it from being used in lethal injection. The problem was that the medical community in the United States started to panic about this because it would have also meant that it might have gotten harder for them to get a hold of propofol for its, what most people would call its, legitimate use in medical practice.
Right. And so why are some of these pharmaceutical companies, because propofol is not the only drug that these pharmaceutical companies are hesitant to be selling to departments of correction. So why are these pharmaceutical companies so hesitant?
Right. Well, I mean, I think pretty much every major pharmaceutical company has come out against their medications being used for lethal injection because they are, after all, medications, you know, and I think just the public perception, kind of the PR of having your medical drug used for that purpose to put someone to death is just not something most companies want to be associated with.
Okay. And so from there, then, what did we see happening here in Missouri? And I think it's very much like the story we've seen in other states as well. Now that these drugs that we were traditionally using or drugs that could get the job done weren't being provided.
Well, initially, I don't know, Chris, do you want to take over?
Sure. So the governor, Governor Jay Nixon, he directed the Department of Corrections to come up with a new way to carry out executions because propofol was really upsetting hospitals if we had gone through with it. So what the Department of Corrections came up with was we're going to use a drug called pentobarbital. But the big difference here is that we're not going to use manufactured pentobarbital. We're going to use pentobarbital coming from what's called a compounding pharmacy. And Veronique can explain a little bit about compounding pharmacies. But the big difference with this is for the first time, Missouri would be keeping the supplier of the drug a secret. And Veronique can talk a little bit about, you know, why the secrecy around the compounding pharmacy would be something important.
Right. So basically, they were, as Chris just said, there were two major changes. One was that they were going to get the drug from the compounding pharmacy, and that the other was that they were going to make the compounding pharmacy or the drug supplier part of the execution team, which meant that they could keep the name of the supplier a secret. So the problem, let's maybe talk first about compounding pharmacies in mm-hmm. general. They're not regulated by the Food and Drug Administration, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, the way a pharmaceutical manufacturer would be. They're supposed to be regulated by the states, but in point of fact, they are less well regulated. In fact, inspections by the Missouri Board of Pharmacy found that one out of every five drugs made by a compounding pharmacy wasn't up to snuff. It didn't meet standards. And that's compared to something like one out of 50 drugs of a commercially manufactured drug meets standards. So so this is a problem because you might wonder why does it matter that a drug that's going to be used in lethal injection is up to snuff or not? And the reason is that a prisoner could really suffer if the drug isn't what it's supposed to be or isn't as strong as it's supposed to be. And the U.S. Constitution protects all of us against cruel and unusual punishment.
Right. And back to that compounding pharmacy, what exactly is a compounding pharmacy for someone who may not know? I mean, how do they usually operate? What's their purpose?
Right. So the legitimate purpose of a compounding pharmacy is to make a specific drug for a specific patient, a drug that wouldn't be commercially available. So sort of the classic example of this would be a pharmacy might make a batch of a drug that's a lower dose than what's commercially available for a child, or they might make it in a liquid formulation that would be more palatable for a child to drink, something like that. So it's really supposed to be tailor-making a drug that isn't commercially available. And of course, pentobarbital is commercially available.
And so, Chris, how did that play out, the use of these compounding pharmacies? There were a couple different stories related to how that worked out here in Missouri.
So the state went to a lot of lengths to try to keep the supplier a secret. The state contends that if their identity were to get out, they wouldn't want to sell for executions anymore. As Veronique mentioned, you know, the quality of compounded drugs varies greatly from batch to batch. And if the identity of the compounding pharmacy is kept secret, you know, we don't know if this pharmacy has been cited in the past. We don't know if they're licensed to sell in the state. Veronique and I spent a couple of months on this, and by piecing it together through a lot of different documents, we eventually found out that the Apothecary Shop, a pharmacy in Tulsa, Oklahoma, was supplying to the Missouri Department of Corrections, and they weren't actually licensed to sell in the state. Which is a problem. That's a problem from a couple of different standpoints. One, because there's a law for it. And then the second one is, as we mentioned, the Food and Drug Administration isn't regulating these compounding pharmacies. It's supposed to be the state boards of pharmacy. And this one was not licensed by the Missouri Board of Pharmacy. After our story aired, probably 3 weeks after that story aired, the Apothecary Shop began the process of becoming licensed to sell in Missouri.
Right. And then after that, too, I mean, now they're no longer in the picture, though, right?
That's well, right. They got sued. They got sued by one of the inmates, inmate Michael Taylor, who was executed last month. He sued the pharmacy saying that the drug that they were making was likely to put him through an intolerable risk of pain. That's kind of unique, is my understanding, because most of the time you have inmates suing the state under Eighth Amendment reasons, which protects you from cruel and unusual punishment. But this was an inmate suing the private institution that was selling the drug to the state. They eventually settled outside of court, and the terms of the settlement, my understanding is that the terms of the settlement were they will not sell for that execution, the terms of which are confidential, though. So it's still unclear if the apothecary shop plans on selling for future executions, because we don't know the exact terms of that settlement, whether it said you can't sell for Michael Taylor's execution or if it said you can't sell to the Missouri Department of Corrections, you know, until the end of time.
And so now there's just another supplier, though, correct?
There is another supplier. It's another compounding pharmacy. I have a lot of open records requests out to the governor's office and the Department of Corrections. Still waiting on a lot of responses to that, but you know, we were ultimately able to find out the identity of the previous compounding pharmacy because we spent a long time on it, and because they made a mistake in one of the redactions. They didn't redact one specific date that eventually let us identify the pharmacy. It's pretty unlikely that they will make that same mistake.
Well, and legally you're constrained because it's correct, but you're legally restrained from even reporting it once you know the name, correct? Because it's
Well, that's complicated. There is a law against identifying members of the execution team. And up until October, the state had defined the members of the execution team as people who were directly involved with carrying out the execution. So the medical personnel who were actually, you know, in bon terre for the execution, you know, the anesthesiologist and the nurses who were there. They expanded that without changing any of the statute, mind you. They expanded that in October and said, no, it also includes this compounding pharmacy that's selling the drug. So far, no federal judge has agreed with them. In fact, several of them have disagreed with the state's assessment, but it still remains very much up in the air whether or not this compounding pharmacy can be a member of the execution team as it's currently defined by state statute.
Yeah, and sort of even the bigger picture, when we were investigating what pharmacy it was in the first place, we talked to a number of pharmacy experts, some of whom questioned the legality of even using a compounding pharmacy in this manner, because really a pharmacy is supposed to be helping to cure people. You know, they're supposed to be making medical products, not manufacturing products to put people to death. So, but it was kind of a gray area, and, you know, certainly at least ethically, it's quite questionable.
Legally gray for that reason, as well as for the reason that we mentioned before, it wasn't licensed to sell in Missouri. And then legally questionable for the third reason, which is, you know, this is a commercially available product and there is a law against compounding pharmacies creating copies of FDA approved drugs, which pentobarbital is.
And Chris, talk a little bit about the lengths that the state went to get the drugs, which is really quite remarkable.
Let me come back to that here in just a second. I just remind our audience that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're trying to shed some light on the process of carrying out executions in Missouri, and the state has made many changes in recent months as it's carried out 4 executions in as many months. Joining us today to sort it out, Paul Litton is an associate professor of law at the University of Missouri. He was a member of a team that put together an analysis of Missouri's death penalty laws, procedures, and practices for the American Bar Association in 2012. And joining us by Skype today are two of our colleagues from St. Louis Public Radio, Chris McDaniel and Veronique LaCapra, who've been leading the coverage of the Department of Corrections efforts to carry out executions in the past few months. For you and our audience, what are your thoughts on the way the Department of Corrections has been accessing the drugs it uses for executions? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. Okay, Chris, sorry for interrupting you. Just pick right up from there. That'd be great.
No. That's perfectly fine. But as Veronique mentioned, the state has gone to great lengths at pretty much every stage in order to keep this compounding pharmacy secret. They signed a confidentiality agreement so that both parties were forbidden from revealing the identity. In fact, one of the people who was in charge of coming up with the new protocol, the director of adult institutions, David Dormeyer, he testified that he was actually transporting a little more than $11,000 in cash every month to this compounding pharmacy. And that's made somewhat even more remarkable in considering that this pharmacy was located in Tulsa, Oklahoma. So you have a high-ranking corrections official who's driving with more than $11,000 all in cash. And they say that that's to, you know, limit the paper trail because this pharmacy has said that they will not do it if it is not in cash.
Right. And so, Paul, we've got a nice primer there on what's been happening the last few months. But maybe some of your thoughts on especially the secrecy involved in all of this process. Is that a problem?
I mean, in my opinion, it is a problem, and here's why. And Chris and Veronique already alluded to it. The U.S. Supreme Court has said that a method of execution can violate the Eighth Amendment if the method presents a substantial or intolerable risk of unnecessary pain when compared with known and feasible alternatives, and if there's reason to worry that these drugs carry a sort of unnecessary risk of pain, and yet, but we can't get really, the inmates can't get any information about it, then they're, in a sense, denied access to information that's really required for them to make their constitutional claim.
Right. And if I'm remembering correctly, I think that's the exact claim that's been made in some of these most recent cases.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I think Michael Taylor, the case that you'd mentioned, Chris and Veronique, that was, I think, the claim he was making. Like, we've been given 2 weeks' notice that this supplier is being switched, right?
And that's essentially what happened in November. I mean, keep in mind, the state wasn't just getting a new supplier in the November execution. They were getting a whole completely new method. And it was ultimately just a few weeks before the execution was set to be carried out. I think that it's important for people to remember that, you know, this is a very new method of execution for Missouri. And you may have been hearing and reading a lot about the court battles, but the ultimate trial over the constitutionality of Missouri's method, that doesn't take place for another couple of months. So I think that a lot of people have the viewpoint that, you know, this is something that the courts have settled, but it's really not. The trial has not even begun yet.
And yet Missouri's been moving ahead with executions in the meantime.
Right. And Veronique, maybe you could help us a little bit too about, we've talked a lot about the drugs, but can you tell us a little about how they actually work, I guess? And, you know, the question is that whole Eighth Amendment, you know, whether these things are humane. What do we know about the drugs that are used, I guess, have been used, and now the one we're talking about using now?
Right. Well, in the past, before all of our reporting started, Missouri had used a three-drug protocol, which I think, I don't remember exactly the three steps that were involved, but one of them basically put you to sleep, and then there was one that kind of paralyzed the inmate, and then there was the one that actually stopped the heart, I believe is how it worked. And now most states have gone to a one-drug protocol, and many states that are carrying out executions are doing it with pentobarbital, which is really, I think, more of an anesthetic, but they're using this sort of mega dose. It's actually a drug that's used in veterinary practice to put dogs and cats to sleep.
And so, yeah, Paul, oh, that, I saw you nodding there.
No, that's right. The older protocol, which I believe is the method in most states still, the first drug was some kind of barbiturate. It had been sodium thiopental. And actually all of this litigation, all the current issues actually came about because Hospira, the manufacturer of sodium thiopental, didn't want that drug used in executions for reasons already stated. The second drug, pancuronium bromide, would be administered to paralyze the inmate, paralyze his diaphragm so he would stop breathing, paralyze his facial muscles, etc., so there was no grimacing, etc. And the third drug, potassium chloride, would cease the heartbeat. And that sort of protocol, the constitutionality of that, had in a sense been litigated. That was the kind of protocol before the Supreme Court in Bayes versus Reese, a 2008 decision. That's the one in which the court came down and said the method can violate the Eighth Amendment if it presents an intolerable or substantial risk of pain when compared to known and feasible alternatives. And that's when a number of states started to go to the one, afterwards, go to the one drug, like Missouri, and we've got into this sort of mess.
Sure. And some other states, too, have been trying other drugs. I think there was also another state that...
Ohio.
Ohio. Tell me about that situation.
He tried a drug, I believe it was...
Midazolam.
Am I saying it correctly?
Yes.
I think so.
Okay. Midazolam. But then there's some worry that there was an execution there where it took a very long time, and there was another execution in, I believe it was Oklahoma, which had used a compounding pharmacy, where there was the inmate had said something like he could feel his body burning as the drug was being sent through.
Right. And so,
And it's worth pointing out the drug that Paul just mentioned in Ohio, midazolam, that's Missouri's backup drug. And we currently have a supply of that drug that lasts until August of this year. We had a story go up last week or 2 weeks ago about that backup drug source.
Right. And so, I guess Veronique, too. I mean, it sounds like these drugs, there's definitely some question, right, scientifically about what that has, the effect it has on people's bodies and what kind of pain they're feeling.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a medical expert, but yes, I think there is a question, because this isn't the intended use of these drugs.
Right, right. Paul, Senator Kurt Schaefer here, mm-hmm. our local guy here in Missouri, was quoted in the Columbia Tribune recently saying, you're not entitled to a pain-free execution. That's not what the law says. Is that
true?
That's
right. No, that's right. Yeah. Like I said, the Supreme Court standard is... The protocol is unconstitutional if it presents a substantial risk of unnecessary suffering when compared to known and feasible alternatives. So he's right. That standard does not require a pain-free execution, but it does require the elimination of substantial risks of unnecessary suffering when there's some other alternative that's feasible. But of course, the problem is that if the inmates don't have access to any sort of information about the drug or the pharmacy being used, then there's no way to compare this execution protocol with the other known and feasible alternatives.
Mm-hmm. I don't know, Veronique and Chris, I wonder your thoughts on that statement from Kurt Schaefer and we're talking about here.
Yes, if I recall correctly, Senator Schaefer has proposed a bill that would actually give the Department of Corrections more latitude in coming up with how they carry out executions. There are a few other bills in the legislature that are more aimed at curtailing their power and bringing it under more scrutiny of the House and the Senate. But as far as the entitlement to a pain-free execution, I mean, Paul's absolutely right in terms of what the legal standard is. It's a really difficult standard for the inmates to meet with all the secrecy that we have. There have been several federal judges who have characterized it as a catch-22, where we are going to set this high legal standard, and we will say that until you meet the standard, you can't get any documents about how you're going to be executed. But it makes it incredibly difficult to meet that standard and say, the way that I'm going to be executed is unconstitutional when I know nothing about the way I'm going to be executed.
You take a moment to remind our audience that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're trying to shed some light on the process of carrying out executions in Missouri, as the state has made many changes in recent months, as it has carried out 4 executions in as many months. Joining us today to sort it out, Paul Litton is an associate professor of law at the University of Missouri. He was a member of a team that put together an analysis of Missouri's death penalty laws, procedures, and practices for the American Bar Association in 2012. And joining us by Skype today are two of our colleagues from St. Louis Public Radio, Chris McDaniel and Veronique LaCapra, who've been leading the coverage of the Department of Corrections' efforts to carry out executions in the past few months. We'd also love to hear from you and our audience. Do you think there needs to be more transparency in the process of carrying out executions in Missouri? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at InterSectKBIA. We'd like to remind you can watch Intersection as streaming video online during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2 at kbia.org. You can watch that video and join our online chat by going to kbia.org and scrolling down to the link for Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2 online at kbia.org. So, Paul, he just mentioned the legal standard is very high for someone on death row appealing. What is he talking about there? What are the standards that someone has to meet in order to challenge these, I guess?
Well, As I mentioned, the standard is from Bayes versus Reese, which plurality opinion written by Chief Justice Roberts, joined by Justices, I believe, Alito and Kennedy, which basically says that the execution protocol, is unconstitutional if it presents a substantial risk of unnecessary pain. It's got to be a substantial risk when compared to known and feasible alternatives. So there's got to be some sort of alternative put forth, and it's got to be shown that there's a substantial risk of increased pain with the protocol being used.
Yeah. Well, and you say that. I mean, Kurt Schaefer, who we mentioned a moment ago, was talking about, Chris, about bringing back gas chambers, which actually is still on the books in Missouri, I think. But
it's in-state statute that the only two methods are lethal injection or the gas chamber. Missouri doesn't have a gas chamber built, and we haven't had one built for a very long time. Attorney General Chris Koster, he's also advocated for bringing back the gas chamber. I don't see that as a legitimate possibility.
Right.
The governor has also said that it's not a legitimate possibility, but it is a way to show that you're tough on crime and show that you're very much in support of the death penalty, which I think is much more what that statement is intended to do.
Yeah, there's a number of firsthand accounts of executions that have taken place with a gas chamber in other states, and the firsthand accounts are that it's a gruesome means of execution. So
yeah.
The idea that the gas chamber would be able to meet the Bayes standard, I'm skeptical that it could.
Right. So what's going on with that kind of statement, I guess? Is it just the fact, I mean, are they really that panicked right now? I mean, obviously we're going to a lot of great measures to carry out executions right now, or is it more of a strategic thing as you're talking about?
No,
Chris?
As far as Senator Schaefer, I mean, his situation is somewhat unique. I mean, he's planning on running for attorney general. So, you know, a part of what the attorney general's job is, especially in Missouri, is litigating death penalty cases. And Attorney General Koster has been doing that. So I think that his statements pertaining to executions particularly pertain to that.
Paul, do you have any other ideas about?
No, I agree.
Same thing.
Well, the bigger picture, though, Ryan, is that I think, you know, this isn't just a Missouri problem. All states are facing this problem. Who are, you know, the states that are trying to carry out lethal injection are all scrambling to try to find drugs because basically no manufacturer wants their drug used this way. And so, you know, they're resorting to compounding pharmacies. As Chris was describing, Missouri resorted to what really was sort of a gray market method of getting a drug. So I think at some point this is going to have to be resolved, you know, more universally to either, you know, if we're going to use lethal injection, if we're going to have the death penalty, then we need to have a way to do it that's more above board, if I can put it that way. You know, there has to be a way to do it.
But I mean, that raises a really interesting, in a sense, almost dilemma for death row inmates, in a sense, which is right, if pharmaceutical manufacturers won't provide the drug, and states are, in a sense, not permitted to get the drug from pharmacies, now the question is, well, is lethal injection a known and feasible alternative? There's a danger, in a sense, that the litigation might lead to sort of abolishing lethal injection as a means to execution, but that doesn't mean it's going to lead to the abolishment of the death penalty.
I do have to take a quick moment. We're going to take a quick break. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Today, we're trying to shed some light on the process of carrying out executions in Missouri. Joining us today to sort it out, Paul Litton is an associate professor of law at the University of Missouri. And joining us by Skype today are two of our colleagues from St. Louis Public Radio, Chris McDaniel and Veronique LaCapra. I'm Ryan Femuelner. We'll be right back after a short break. Welcome back to Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're trying to shed some light on the process of carrying out executions in Missouri, as the state has made many changes in recent months, as it's carried out 4 executions in as many months. Joining us today to sort it out, Paul Litton is an associate professor of law at the University of Missouri. He was a member of a team that put together an analysis of Missouri's death penalty laws, procedures, and practices for the American Bar Association in 2012. And joining us by Skype today are two of our colleagues from St. Louis Public Radio, Chris McDaniel and Veronique LaCapra, who have been leading the coverage of the Department of Corrections' efforts to carry out executions in the past few months. And for you and our audience, do you think members of the execution team should be able to be anonymous? What about the drug supplier? Share your thoughts. Give us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia or join our online chat. And yeah, we talked about that a little bit in the first half hour. I know, Veronique, I know you brought it up, the fact that the members of the execution team have been anonymous for quite some time. What's that part of the conversation like as far as the medical personnel that are involved in executions and the roles and importance of that, I guess?
Well, I think that originated with the anesthesiologist who's involved in executions. There was an investigation on the part of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch into that earlier on, and they found that, you know, the person who was serving as the anesthesiologist really wasn't qualified. I don't know the whole story on that, but
it was in 2006 or 2007.
2006 or 2007, and that's when the members of the execution team were made basically were protected from having their identities revealed.
What was exposed was apologize.
Yeah, Paul, go for it.
Is that the anesthesiologist who had been involved? There were a number of malpractice lawsuits filed against him, and also that he had dyslexia, which is a problem since he was mixing the drugs. Mm. So there were questions about whether he was competently mixing the drugs and getting the concentration correct because he had this condition. So there. The state of Missouri agreed before a federal court to stop using his services, but the federal court did not require the state to put an anesthesiologist on the team. The court said basically, you don't need an anesthesiologist because the real skill of the anesthesiologist is to, in a sense, knock someone out but then be able to revive them, and that's not really...
It's not the goal here.
It's not the goal here.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, I think our understanding is that they have found another anesthesiologist to participate.
Yeah. So why is it complicated, though, to have these medical personnel, to find these medical personnel to be involved?
Well, first off, all professional medical organizations have codes of ethics, and the codes of ethics universally condemn physician participation or nurse participation, et cetera, in executions. So these codes of ethics condemn it. There's controversy about whether it's unethical for a doctor or nurse to participate. There was a physician interviewed in an article that came out in the New England Journal of Medicine around 7 or 8 years ago who admitted that he took part in executions even though he was against the death penalty. He did it because he said, this was back when the context was the 3-drug protocol, and he said, look, there's risks of suffering. If that first drug is not delivered properly, the second and third drugs are going to cause immense suffering. I know my services can reduce the risk of incredible suffering. I shouldn't abandon this person at this hour, right? He's, in a sense, like a dying person with a disease. I'm a physician. I can actually help and reduce the risk of suffering. So he said he actually argued, and I think he has some points. I think it's a very difficult issue, really difficult issue, to say that actually it's his obligation to actually participate and help. But obviously, it's very controversial.
Yeah, and I mean, you need to have some medical professionals. Like you said, there's debate whether an anesthesiologist is specifically needed, but you need to have some medical
professionals. Well, you need someone who's got some experience in putting in the IV and someone who knows the pace at which the drug should be delivered through the IV. But does it need to be a physician? Does it need to be a nurse? No. Someone with this necessary sort of training.
Well, currently my understanding is for the Department of Corrections, the medical personnel that they have on staff actually in Bon Terre for the executions, their role is more of oversight instead of actually administering the drug, administering the IV, those are actually corrections employees. And those are also confidential, of course.
Another thing that's come up that was kind of interesting in the last few executions is that I know, Chris and Veronique, you've done some reporting on this, that there were actually still some appeals pending. Is that right? And when some people were executed, the last few here in the state. Can you talk about that a little bit?
So for three out of the last four executions, there were still pending stays while the state carried out executions. That's something that is very controversial within the legal community. It's something that a few federal judges have criticized the state and the Attorney General's office for giving the okay. Paul can go into a little bit more about pending stays and what those mean, I'm sure.
Yeah. Sure. Well, it is rare, I mean, in general.
Yeah, not recently, but...
Not recently, right. For there to be no applications for stays at the point when the person is executed. Here, I believe the state is saying, hey, look, defense attorneys have put forth all legitimate claims. All legitimate claims have been addressed by the courts and rejected. Insofar as a further application for a stay is being put forth before a court, the claims aren't legitimate, and so it's okay for us to go forward. It is true. It's rare in general. There have been a few times when the Supreme Court has said, we're not going to accept any more arguments from the inmate. That didn't happen in these cases yet.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and there have been a few federal judges who criticized the state, and the state certainly contends that, you know, the attorneys representing these inmates are using delay tactics because the state only has an execution warrant that's valid for 24 hours. But there have been federal judges who say that's not your role. You don't get to make those decisions. You know, a few federal judges have criticized the state for putting it as Missouri's carried out executions before the courts have decided whether doing so would violate the Constitution.
Yeah, well, I guess that's a basic question, not just about this, but a lot of the things we've talked about here. We've talked about how there's a lot of secretive action happening. I mean, we've talked about a gray market. Paul, how much of this is it clear how much of this is legal, or do we know if there could be some things happening that might actually be illegal right now?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think Chris already talked about the laws that the state might have broke in securing the drugs from the compounding pharmacies. Now, the question is, does the inmate have any remedy,
right?
Given the fact that the state's breaking those laws? And the fact that the state's breaking those laws doesn't necessarily imply that the Eighth Amendment is being violated. So it's really just the law could be broken without the inmate really having that sort of the remedy being sought.
So to piggyback on that statement, what Paul is talking about is the laws that the state would be violating in procuring this drug from a pharmacy that isn't licensed to sell in the state, that's not something that I, as a private citizen, can sue the state for. That's something that the Board of Pharmacy would have to go after them for. And the Missouri Board of Pharmacy, those members are actually appointed by the governor, who's played a very important role in all of this. So there aren't a lot of ways that these inmates can get action against the state if the state has broken any laws.
Well, and on top of that, I think buying from an unlicensed pharmacy, the person who's breaking the law is the pharmacy in doing the selling.
Right.
So it's really the Oklahoma pharmacy that would be violating the law, not the Missouri Department of Corrections.
Yeah.
Right. And so, and Chris and Veronique, what have, in your reporting, what have you seen from these entities that have been involved? Have they been answering questions about the legality of what they've been doing?
Well, the Missouri Board of Pharmacy, as I just mentioned, they're appointed by the governor. They've also... we reached out to them for comment before we published our story, saying that this pharmacy was not licensed to sell in the state. Shortly after we reached out to them for comment, they were contacted by the general counsel for the governor's office. So they've certainly been in talks with the governor's office. The inmates have filed complaints with the Missouri Board of Pharmacy asking them to investigate. So far, the Missouri Board of Pharmacy has not. The Oklahoma Pharmacy or the Oklahoma Board of Pharmacy has also not investigated the apothecary shop.
I mean, this may seem like an obvious question, but have others have you gotten much feedback from others outside these main players on whether they're okay with this process? You know what I mean? Other state entities or other just your general listeners, things like that. What kind of reaction you've been getting as you've been reporting all this?
Well, the other people who could go after this compounding pharmacy for potentially breaking the law would be the U.S. Attorney's Office, because there's a federal law that prohibits them making a copy of an FDA-approved drug. I think that would be something that would be pretty unpopular. Typically, you don't like to see the federal government interfering in what is typically something that is left to the states in the death penalty. As far as the response we've gotten from our audience, I mean, it's very divisive, as you would imagine with anything about the death penalty. I think that the people who see this as a story about the death penalty view it negatively, and then the people who view this as government secrecy tend to view it more positively, that our stories are shining a light on something that has been very opaque. But, you know, the death penalty remains popular in Missouri. It gets less popular every year, but I believe nationwide it's still at about 59%, which is the lowest it's been, but it's still 59%.
We mentioned earlier some legislation that might be going into changing some of these processes. What kind of legislation's out there, and what do we think might have a chance? Whoever has some ideas on that.
Well, I can jump in. There are a few different bills. A couple of them would essentially bring oversight for the Department of Corrections methods to the Missouri legislature. Some of them would set up a committee for it. Others would use an existing committee, and they would basically say, we're going to use this committee to come up with the rules, because right now it's being done by three people in secret, none of whom are elected. What's interesting about that is, you know, you'll have your typical liberal Democrats who are against the death penalty who are proposing it, but there are some pro-death penalty Republicans who support this legislation as well, who are saying, I am supportive of the death penalty. I believe strongly in that, but this process has to be more transparent. And I don't know if any of these bills stand a chance, because the Missouri legislature is a very conservative legislature, but it remains to be seen.
Paul, what's your thought on some of this legislation, and I guess its chances?
On the ones that Chris talked about, I mean, I share his sentiments. Mm-hmm. There has been some other bills proposed in the last year or two regarding the death penalty. Senator Kevney has tried to pass a bill that would require the state auditor to assess how much the death penalty costs Missouri taxpayers, and that hasn't really succeeded. I think he's going to try again. Mm-hmm. And there's some other bills related to the criminal justice system that are related to the death penalty, but not isolated to the death penalty.
Yeah. What's the purpose? You mentioned that Senator Kevney or Representative Kevney.
Senator.
Okay. You mentioned that. What's the purpose of that, I guess? What would be the goal of having the auditor look at that, the costs?
I mean, I think the idea is to let Missouri taxpayers and citizens know how much the death penalty is actually costing the state. There's very good evidence from other states where studies have been done that shows that the death penalty costs the state more money, sometimes three times as much more money, to seek the death penalty on a particular defendant than the state would spend if the state just sought to put the person in prison for life without parole. And I think the idea is, hey, let's just get this study done in Missouri, see if the same is true here. And that would just help inform public debate about the death penalty in Missouri, because I think one myth about the death penalty, I think, is that it actually costs more to keep the person alive, in prison for 40 or so years. It's just cheaper to just execute the person. And the evidence from other states is, well, that's not true.
Oh, really? So what goes into making it actually more expensive to execute?
Well, the primary cause of the increased expense is the fact that there's a separate sentencing trial. So when a capital defendant, when the state tries someone capitally, there could be a guilt phase trial on whether the person is guilty of the crime. And then if the person is guilty of the highest degree of murder, then there could be a sentencing trial, in which case the jury, the fact finder, whether it's the jury or the judge, if the jury is waived, has to decide on the appropriate sentence. And that is a very, very expensive trial. The Supreme Court has basically said the defendant has a right under the Eighth Amendment to put on any evidence related to – any relevant evidence related to his character, his record, the circumstances of the offense. And really, these sentencing trials turned out to be basically trials on the defendant's entire life. And there are a lot of – there are multiple attorneys involved. There are forensic specialists involved, psychiatrists involved. There's a lot of human resources are used in this sentencing trial. And then now, on the in the appeal stage, both the guilt phase and the sentencing trial can be appealed. It's just a very expensive process.
Take a moment to remind our listeners that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ryan Famuliner, and today we're trying to shed some light on the process of carrying out executions in Missouri, as the state has made many changes in recent months as it has carried out 4 executions in 4 months. Joining us today to sort it out, Paul Litton is an associate professor of law at the University of Missouri. He was a member of a team that put together an analysis of Missouri's death penalty laws, procedures, and practices for the American Bar Association in 2012. And joining us by Skype today are two of our colleagues from St. Louis Public Radio, Chris McDaniel and Veronique LaCapra, who have been leading the coverage of the Department of Corrections' efforts to carry out executions in the past few months. For you and our audience, do you think changes need to be made in the way the state carries out executions, or do you think it should just move forward as it has? Let us know by giving us a call at 573-882-8925 or email intersection@kbia.org. You could also tweet us at intersectkbia. And Paul, I kept mentioning that work you had done with the Bar Association. Maybe tell me a little bit about what you your group found in that process.
Sure. So the charge to our committee, which was made up of a bipartisan group of lawyers, ex-prosecutors, defense attorneys, judges, and law professors, was to assess the extent to which Missouri's laws and practices conform to recommendations that the American Bar Association has published. These guidelines have the purpose of trying to establish a fair and accurate system. And some of the things we found that the Missouri complies with a number of the recommendations from the American Bar Association. In general, the quality of defense counsel in capital cases in Missouri is very good. Been extensive efforts on the part of the bar to talk about the importance of having an independent judiciary and the importance to of an independent judiciary to fairness. We found some other areas where we concluded that Missouri was not in compliance. In our opinion, we made some positive recommendations on issues that we felt very strongly about. And in my opinion, the most important ones had to do with recommendations that would have an impact beyond the capital system. And the reason why I think those are very important is death cases make up a very small percentage of the criminal justice system. I mean, they're obviously extremely important. But some of these recommendations are important to capital cases and non-capital cases. And the recommendations have to do with reducing the risk of convicting the innocent. So we do know that wrongful convictions is a bigger problem than we used to think. And the number one reason is mistaken eyewitness identifications. So we made a recommendation for the state to require law enforcement to adopt what are known as sort of best practices in light of our best social sciences, and procedures that we know help reduce the risk of mistaken eyewitness identifications. Mm-hmm. We also recommended that the state preserve biological evidence in all serious felony cases. The state's not preserving all biological evidence.
Oh, really? They're not required to right now?
Not in all felony cases. And that, I mean, the biological evidence is important for both exculpating the innocent, but also inculpating the guilty.
Right.
And we also recommend giving the police more incentive to video record interrogations in such cases. There is a statute now that does require custodial interrogations, but it doesn't really have much teeth. And so police don't have adequate, incentive to video record all custodial interrogations in serious cases. And we recommended that the statute give police more incentive to do so. because it helps, again, minimize the risk of false confessions and wrongful conviction.
Right. So as you said, a lot of this would apply not necessarily just to the death penalty. This is just the legal system in general for many of this stuff.
Exactly. And we made some recommendations that are just about the capital system, but those ones, I think, are important to all serious cases.
Sure, sure. And back to the conversation we've kind of been having for most of this hour here. You hear all this, the conversations we had, especially with the coverage that Veronique and Chris has been talking about at the beginning. What do you think people should know about all that? I mean, we've kind of been at the whole point of this in some ways is to make sure people are educated about those stories and those issues. But what do you think the public is not necessarily aware of right now in relation to all that and the way this is carried out in the state right now?
Well, I mean, things that I think we've talked about, mm-hmm. which is, right, why is it important to know about the drug? People don't know much about the fact that the Supreme Court has said an execution protocol can violate the Constitution if it presents a risk of unnecessary pain. I think people are unaware of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people are generally unaware of about a lot of facts about the death penalty, about who gets it, who doesn't get it, why some people get it, why some people don't. I think people don't really know about the cost. And I think these are all things that should inform public debate. I think when you hear public debate, there's a lot of emphasis on whether or not some people deserve it because their crimes are so horrible, and they are. But that's just sort of a starting point. There are many considerations regarding the justifiability or the importance of the death penalty that are relevant, even if one concedes the claim that some people deserve it.
Yeah. Chris and Veronique, I wonder your thoughts on that too, and if there's anything that people aren't just getting about this issue as you've been covering it.
Well, the goal throughout all of our reporting was that carrying out executions is arguably the state's biggest power that they have. I mean, this is one of the more tangible aspects of a larger government is the ability to carry out the death penalty. A large part of our role is providing oversight when the state exercises its largest power. And this is something that the state tries to ensure has the least amount of transparency. So we've tried to provide that. And we think that that's important so that there can be a public debate and a public discussion about the methods that the state's been going out. I think that people are aware of executions in a very vague sense. And they know that they occur, but they have little indication of how they are carried out in the states and the lengths that the state has gone to.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think, people have a visceral reaction to the notion of executions. I think people are either very strongly in favor of them or very strongly against them for, personal reasons, and they really don't understand how they're being carried out. And I think it's important to understand that process.
Sure. And again, we've talked about this earlier in the show. This is very much a problem happening all over the country. This is not just a Missouri situation, I guess. Are other states having the same discussions and same difficulties now? Are there states that are figuring this out? Or what is it looking like elsewhere right now?
Absolutely, other states are. For the reasons, again, already stated, the drug manufacturers don't want to supply the drugs, so the states are in discussion about, how are we going to get our hands on the drugs we want to use to execute people?
Right.
So it's very, very similar. Same thing in Ohio, Oklahoma,
Louisiana,
et cetera. Sorry?
Louisiana as well.
Louisiana. Yeah.
Louisiana.
Have you in your reporting, Chris and Veronique, seen anything especially interesting from other states aside from what we've talked about so far?
Well, the pharmacy that sold Missouri its execution drug also offered to sell to Louisiana. It seems like Louisiana didn't take them up on that offer, but that pharmacy was also not licensed to sell in Louisiana. Louisiana's currently has its executions put on hold. A federal judge has told the state that they have to reveal who's supplying the state with its execution drug. I really wouldn't say that any state has it figured out, and I certainly wouldn't say that there's going to be any closure or any sort of judicial say that's going to have a lot of lasting appeal for any time soon.
Sure, and I guess state by state, it's going to depend on how some of the leaders react to the situation, right? I mean, we've talked a lot about the different entities here involved, the Attorney General, the Governor, Department of Corrections. But in these other states, there may be some other leeway, I guess, and the stance that different leaders decide to take, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, the whole thing about the death penalty is the reason that it's legal is because we're saying we're carrying out executions because that is the will of the public. And we're providing this information so that we can have that discussion, so that we can actually make an informed decision about what we want to do. You know, we've reported on the execution controversy for a few months, and it involves the two top Democrats, Governor Jay Nixon and Attorney General Chris Coster. But, you know, it's very much uncertain if that is something that's going to damage them. Chris Coster is going to run for governor, but the death penalty is something that at this current moment is something that's very popular. It would be speculative to you know, try to say how much the government secrecy aspect is going to hurt them for the governor's office withholding records and with his appointments to the Department of Corrections. You know, it's hard to say how this will impact them.
I mean, these sorts of debates, again, this is speculating, you know, might have more of an impact in states where maybe the death penalty isn't used as much. Mm-hmm. We're one of the, in a sense, one of the leaders. I mean, we're not Texas,
right?
But we're in the top five or six in terms of number of people executed since the 70s. But just to draw a parallel, over the past number of years during the economic crisis, with knowledge that the death penalty is more expensive, some states that didn't use it very much got rid of it. Because of the expense, New Jersey, Maryland, some other states, Connecticut. It's possible, maybe in some states that don't use it very much and they're having this kind of difficulty with it and a lot of litigation over the execution method, maybe a few others might get rid of it. Again, that's just speculating, but I think Chris and Veronica are also right. I mean, it's more popular here. It's used, and I'm not sure it's going to have a great impact.
Sure.
On whether we have the death penalty or not.
Yeah, Veronique, I think
talked in the beginning about how the European Union is strongly against the death penalty, and really the U.S. is an outlier in the developed world. Paul can correct me if I'm misstating anything, but I mean, we're really the only developed country that continues to carry out the death penalty.
Yeah. I believe Japan.
Japan also
Japan,
has the death penalty.
But so I guess just a little bit left in the show. But how likely and what would have to happen for those states that momentum to carry through and actually have some states decide to move away from using the death penalty?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, like I said,
it's speculation.
The states that have gotten rid of it over the last few years are states that really weren't using it.
Okay.
I don't see any of that happening here. Definitely not where the state, you know, outlaws the death penalty. But I think that it is something reasonable and something that could happen within the Missouri legislature that they say we want to be able to provide more oversight. I think that is something that could happen.
Well, we're going to have to end it for there today. That's all the time we have for today's Intersection. Thanks to our guests, Paul Litton, an associate professor of law at the University of Missouri. He was a member of the team that put together an analysis of Missouri's death penalty laws, procedures, and practices for the American Bar Association in 2012. And joining us by Skype, two of our colleagues from St. Louis Public Radio and The Beacon, Chris McDaniel and Veronique LaCapra. We'd like to remind those of you enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch live streaming video of our program each Monday afternoon online at kbia.org. Alongside that video, you can submit your questions and comments and take part in an online discussion with others in the audience. You'll also find an archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is a broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Intersection is produced by Janet Saidi, Casey Morell, and Ruben Stern. Travis McMillan is our technical director with production assistance from Rachel Gangware, Austin Federa, and Mark Bergen. Pat Akers is our audio producer. Executive directors are Mike Dunn and Mike McKean. And I'm Ryan Famuliner. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great week.